Greetings, this is James Gillen with As You Wish Talk Radio. We've got a great guest tonight. I'm going to go right into it rather than talking about the weather or any of the other phenomenon that's happening around here. But we've got Asha from the Self-Realization Fellowship, or the Ananda Retreat. Hopefully I'm saying this right. I'm sure she'll correct me. But it's in Palo Alto, and I've been there before, and it has amazing energy there. I've had a long history of Eastern thought and training, so it fits right into some of the other things I'm involved with. And rather than messing up the airways too much, I'd like to bring Asha on for the show. Asha, are you with us?
I'm right here, James. Nice to hear your voice.
Oh, it's great to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I've worked a lot in other levels with. You know, it's even in my bio in my book. I talked about a lot of my own experiences with Babaji and some of the other masters. And we had a really good meditation group that was going on one day, and the whole group was started smelling gardenias.
Mm.
And the entire room just filled with gardenias. And I understand that's one of Yogananda's favorite flowers, and he seems to bring it with him when he comes into a room.
Yeah, it was always the tradition that gardenias were his favorite. People would give them to him as gifts.
Mm-hmm.
Even now, they keep gardenias in the rooms where he lived.
Yeah, it's quite interesting how they bring fragrances with them sometimes when they enter a room in spirit.
Interesting, very interesting.
Now you work there at Ananda, is that...
Yes, my husband and I, Ananda has a number of communities, and mm-hmm. we have a community here in Palo Alto, California, where... My husband and I are, we helped get it started, and we live here, and we help direct the community.
Oh, great. I've been there before. I didn't have time to participate in any of the events going on there, or the classes or services, unfortunately, because I was just kind of traveling through at the time. But I did love the energy there.
Well, you put a lot of people together in one place. They meditate and do spiritual work together for a long period of time. The whole atmosphere changes. You can feel it just when you walk onto the land, into the room. Even if the room is empty, you can still feel what's been planted there.
Yeah, you can probably cut the energy with a knife.
Well, I was just away for a little more than a week, and just coming home late at night, just getting out of the car and standing on the property, the community property where we've lived for the last 20 years, you just could tell you're in another dimension in some subtle way, even though you were still on the earth plane here.
Yeah, we have that problem here. We're right on top of a vortex. We're broadcasting from the vortex, actually. And all kinds of phenomena happen here. And what's really strange is that the veils are so thin here. If you're focused on the masters, you'll have that experience. If you're, you know, focused on the nature spirits, you'll see the nature spirits. And it even goes into the UFOs and the ultra-dimensional beings and orbs and you name it. There's light spheres everywhere here.
Very interesting. Well, there's so much more going on in this world than many people understand. It's always been a surprise to me that people take the world for what it is and not really ask deeper questions about what's going on behind it. It's so much more comforting to look deeper than just to live on the surface of things.
Yeah, I noticed that a lot of people just want to hang out as a body and a personality, and that's it, and they're comfortable there. And they pretty much only care about their next paycheck and, you know, how they're going to cover their house payment and their car payment and pretty much stuck in base survival.
Well, the Bhagavad Gita talks about it. It's just that the Gita describes three kinds of ignorance. One is like smoke obscuring a fire, one is rust on a mirror, and the third is like the unborn child in the womb. And smoke on the fire can be dissipated with a breath, rust on the mirror takes some effort to scrub off, but the unborn child in the womb simply has to wait until the time is right.
Mm-hmm.
And people on the planet, this is a planet in which many different levels of understanding coexist simultaneously, and each soul is simply working its way through its grade level, so to speak, in the natural order. It can't be rushed.
Yeah, it seems to be there's something going on. I don't know if you want to call it the, they have so many different names for it, you know, the Hunter's Monkey or, or, you know, there's all these names for this major shift that's going on right now. Are you experiencing that as well with people just, you know, busting wide open now and seeing through the veils and the illusions and just seeing how transparent everything is?
Well, Yogananda talks about it even in his basic book, Autobiography of a Yogi. And he talks about the tradition of the yugas, is what he calls it, the ages on the planet, and that we are in a transition out of the age of matter into the age of energy. When I say we, I say the basic understanding of this planet, because individuals live at whatever level is true for them, no matter what the planet is doing. But what I see is there's like a polarization going on, because at the same time that there's this enormously enlightened, more enlightened ray that many people are tuning into, you also see, you know, this almost an increase in the darkness. It's like much of the time the world is, as Swami Kriyananda, my teacher, says, the world is shaped more like a cigar, and most people hang out sort of in the middle, but at times like this it gets more like a dumbbell, where it's very thin in the middle, and your people are being pulled in two directions very strongly, one or the other.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious. What they've been telling us, you know, is that there's this vibrational lifting going on, and that the higher consciousness and energy doesn't really have an ego. It doesn't judge this is good or that's bad or anything else. It just amplifies everything. And so it seems the polarities are being amplified. And like you're saying, that the dark seem to be getting darker and the light seem to be getting lighter, and the gray areas in between just aren't really there anymore.
It's harder to be neutral. The extremes are too strong. Yogananda spoke of things getting worse before they get better, that it is going in an upward direction, but that the two forces will, there'll be bigger clashes even than we've seen, was what he predicted.
Mm-hmm.
And then the light force will have greater ascendancy for a time. But this planet's not meant to be perfect. It's a place where we come to learn. It's not where we come to live forever. So it needs to make us uncomfortable. Otherwise, where would the incentive be? Few are inspired to go forward, at least in the early stages, out of a vision of light. Most of us have to be motivated out of a desire to escape what we're not enjoying.
Yeah, they say until you've drank in a belly full of that sour wine, you know, you're not going to be done with it.
Right. And many people are simply content with things as they seem. Mm-hmm. And when I was a young child, I remember staring out the window. I used to think when I was a child that everybody, all the adults knew this, you know, this great meaning of life. And that somehow at a certain age they would reveal it to me. It was very disconcerting for me when I gradually realized that so many of the people around me simply accepted things as they were. They didn't have the same inner sense of this can't be all there is. There must be something more. In fact, it was when I was 22 and I met Swami Kriyananda, who's a direct disciple of Paramhansa Yogananda. Almost literally the instant I met him, I realized that he was the first person I'd met who somehow in himself embodied the deeper understanding that I intuitively knew was there, but I didn't know how to reach for it. It was a really, of course, a absolutely pivotal moment in my life.
You know, out of curiosity, was he kind of childlike himself with kind of a wicked sense of humor?
Oh, Kriyananda, well, he still is. He's in the present.
Oh, he's still around.
He's 81, but he's still with us. But yes, he's exactly that. He's childlike. I don't know, wicked. He's not wicked in any way, but
not wicked.
He has a magnificent sense of humor. I know that's a word. He has a magnificent sense of humor because he has this extraordinary capacity to see life in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And when you keep perspective, you also keep humor. You know, fanatics usually don't have a sense of humor because they have no perspective. But if you can keep a sense of humor, that means you can keep a perspective on things. You remember that we're just tourists passing through,
mm-hmm.
and there's no reason not to enjoy yourself as you go.
You know, one of the lamas that I stay with, I love what he said. He said, the reason there's so few enlightened beings on the planet is because it's so damn simple, and we've made all these very complicated teachings and constructs, but he said you just focus on love and joy and bliss until you become it.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that is the nature of God. And I've always felt that when you really see somebody who's enlightened, you know, they have this incredible bliss or joy around them, and they also have an incredibly developed sense of humor as well. That's just pretty unlimited.
Well, that is the truth. You know, with Swami Kriyananda, whom I have lived closely with now for almost 40 years, I lost my train of thought. What you see in him is we're talking about the bliss and the joy. There's just
mm-hmm.
sort of an ease. Not that life isn't difficult, and not that one doesn't face really almost literally all the same challenges, but there's always this understanding that the purpose of what we're doing is to develop our consciousness. And so even when the struggle is difficult, there's always that part of yourself that you know you're like in the gym working out. And even if you're having to lift really heavy weights, you know why you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I know a woman once came to him for counseling, and she was under the misunderstanding that if she became devoted to the spiritual path, that it would get easier. And it hadn't. Life hadn't, like, suddenly all the obstacles had not been removed, and she thought somehow she'd been cheated. And you know, he tried to reassure her. She wasn't able to understand, but he was trying to explain to her, but you understand why it's happening. There's meaning behind the experience, and that changes everything.
Yeah, it seems one of the basic premises are the closer you get to the light, you know, the more the darkness rears its ugly head. You know, there's no lot of sayings around that. Is that the challenges are greater, and you really have to face your beast.
Well, you do. You have to overcome everything that has the capacity to interrupt your peace of mind and your faith in the benevolent good. And the more dedicated you become to that, you have to keep lifting weights that are a little stronger than you are. Otherwise, how will you gain any strength? If the capacity of growth is truly infinite, then we simply have to keep going until we attain that infinity. So a little bit is not good enough.
It seems like you were saying earlier, there are so many people that are content with not even getting the weight set, you know, or not even acknowledging that you know, growth and spiritual growth and engaging the higher conscious energy. They have just no desire whatsoever. They are focused just on the material, and that's pretty much it for them.
Well, but you know, it may be a great progress for them to have enough energy even to become materialistic. It's all, people use the phrase, it's all relative,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't mean that it's random. There is a center toward which we're all moving, but it's a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
And what's forward for one person may be backward for someone else. So you have to judge people according to where they are on the continuum, not where they are on an absolute scale, so to speak, if you judge at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like the old saying that they say that there's... nobody knows what another soul needs for completion, and they may have completed all these other higher tests or lessons, you might say, and they're just coming back and cleaning, you know, finishing up one last little thing they haven't done yet.
Well, that's one way to look at it. Living with Swamiji Kriyananda, he's very practical in his understanding, and it's just a simple matter of gradual expansion of consciousness, and just as, you know, some people are more advanced than others. And it's not, there's no judgment in it, but it is a fact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the reality for me of having this experience with Swamiji, as I call him, which mm-hmm. simply means teacher, is that I really have been able to understand how far we can evolve. And even though I'm happy, you know, to have woken up to the extent that I have, it keeps one from being complacent when you see the great distance that we can travel. The life story of Yogananda and my living experiences with Kriyananda have really... And then you just look with gratitude at people who are traveling the path that we've all traveled and be happy for them and help them as you can.
Yeah, that's why I named this radio show As You Wish. Talk radio. I had my own near-death experience, and I ended up in that plane of bliss for a while and came back, and that's the last words I heard were, as you wish. You know?
As you wish. Because you were returning?
Yes. Yeah, because I asked quite a few questions. The first question I asked was, how can I stay?
Uh-huh.
And there was a communication that came back to me and it said, I never told one of my children when to come or go. That's free will.
Huh.
And then I asked, how can I earn the right to stay? And you know, the communication came back to me and says, you cannot earn what is given freely and unconditionally. And I'm saying, okay, wait a minute. And I said, okay, well, how can I serve? Because you just want to give back when you experience this complete love and joy and bliss and security. That's all you want to do is serve and give back. And I waited for a long time, and I was waiting to get some big long list, you know, of all these things I'm supposed to do and people I'm supposed to talk to and heal or comfort or whatever. And I didn't hear anything for a long time, and I was waiting and waiting, and in that, what they call, you're in the arms of God or the cradle of bliss. And the voice came back to me, and it says, what do you want to do? What brings you joy? And I thought about it, and I said, you know, I want to come back and teach people about the true nature of God and get rid of all these graven images of these punishing, wrathful gods and gods separate from humanity and nature and all this other nonsense. And the last words I heard were, as you wish.
What an interesting story.
Yeah, so I named the radio show that, and I realized that, you know, like the sun, the source, whatever you want to call God, just says, as you wish. It shines its rays evenly on everybody, doesn't judge anybody or hold back anything from anybody, but, you know, we choose how much of that we want to absorb or work with or experience.
I know, when I was saying earlier, when I was a child, I had such an intense desire to help people, and simultaneously I knew that I didn't know enough to be able to help them, and that was always the dilemma of my life. And when I met Swami Kriyananda, who was then building the communities of Ananda, which I have now helped start two of them, I saw in him the perfect balance of the effort to achieve individual enlightenment combined with a continuous willingness also to share the light to the best of his ability and to create a reality, which now we have seven communities around the world and so many things have happened where thousands of people are able to partake of that light. And from the very earliest that I was there, I was so intensely interested in learning from him. And from the very beginning, I started having a lot of experiences with him, and there was always this thought in my mind that these experiences are not just given to me. And you know that I recently published a book called Swami Kriyananda as We Have Known Him,
mm-hmm.
which is about him as a person, but what it really is, it's about how to live practically the spiritual life. It's not always easy to make that shift from the ideal of bliss that you're describing and just an everyday reality of how you treat people, how you work, how you deal with problems of money, how you deal with marriage and children. And because Kriyananda set us up with communities where we live not as monastics but as families with children and so on, the whole reality of it has been very grounded in this world. And so I've just written up, you know, hundreds and hundreds of specific examples of stories from his life and the life of the community of how to make that shift from that bliss world that you touched into this world here, which is no easy challenge.
No, it's tough. I went and lived in the Redwoods after it happened.
Uh-huh.
And I had to because I couldn't function here. Everything had energy around it.
Uh-huh.
And I would feel, you know, people would think one thing, say something else, and feel something entirely different.
Mm.
And I was getting the input on all three levels, and it's very hard to function in the world. It took me, you know, a couple of years just to settle down where I could find that space of non-judgment and just allow people to be who they are, even though it wasn't congruent, and not have it affect me.
Right, not have it affect you. Have enough in, you know, the art of not shut down your heart, but not have your heart be bruised by other people's suffering. I finally, with Swamiji, I learned from him that the courage of the heart,
uh-huh.
the fearlessness, if one really knows that God is love and we are one with that love, then what? Why would we fear anything? What can anyone do to us?
Exactly.
Yeah.
One of the things that happened with me, my own experience, was I started seeing beings, like beautiful light beings, and having incredible experiences, but I also ran into some pretty dark beings that I wasn't prepared for.
Right.
And so I had to go through some extensive training on how to, you know, heal unseen negative influences and, you know, walk in my own self-authority and shield myself from these other energies as well. And it was a pretty intense learning experience. And I was told that I had to walk through that. That was something I needed to understand, and that it was real, and know how to deal with this and how to heal these influences. And I've always felt that that should be a program that goes right along with meditation. If people are going to expand into these other realms, they need to learn how to maintain that higher consciousness and energy and heal any unseen negative influences, or be in the presence of somebody that is going to hold that sacred space and keep it, you know, clean of those kind of influences.
Well, that's where the tradition of having a spiritual master assist you really comes from, because then you're walking the mountain with a guide. Even
mm-hmm.
though you still have to put one foot in front of the other, if you have the companionship, the inner or the outer companionship of someone who knows the trail, you still may go to the brink of death or even over the brink, but nonetheless the guide will be there helping your footsteps
mm-hmm.
every step of the way. You know, the right kind of meditation brings that kind of power with it. So you're right, it's an inherent training, whether it's explicit or implicit in the technique.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be there. Otherwise, you know, when I first started on the spiritual path in my early 20s, it was like paradise. I lived in this mountain ashram, and Swamiji was there, Kriyananda was there teaching us, and we were very isolated. People came, we had a retreat, but we really lived our own life. It was like it was like the being in the astral world. It was like not being on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Lasted, you know, 15 years even. It was a long time. Into the into the 80s. But then we ended up with challenging periods, and various things happened. And, you know, there's the happiness because you don't know that there's anything to take it away from you. And then there's the deliberately chosen happiness that comes after you've been through difficulties and faced them down, and realize that your strength is not an accident, but a power that's within you that you've learned to tap. It's not always pleasant to go through the middle ground. You know, you describe it as meeting those dark forces and learning to heal them. However, it's the natural progression of spiritual life, from innocence to understanding to true wisdom.
Uh-huh. It's quite interesting. I noticed that Yogananda had quite a few challenges when he was building the center there. I know he had all kinds of forces on his perimeters, and people trying to, buy the land up around him and move property lines, and just all kinds of challenges around the Palo Alto Center.
Oh, it's always a challenge. Whenever the light really makes an effort, then you activate the duality of it. And whether you call them tests from God, or whether you call them Satan or dark forces, whatever you do, there's a counterforce. It's partly because once an individual commits to self-realization, really, to the purification of one's own consciousness, you have to purify your consciousness. You don't just sort of roll downhill into a blissful state of ecstasy. It's a paradox, because it's very simple. This is where the conversation started. It's very simple, but it takes an absolute concentration, and you have to be willing to face and expunge all limiting conditions of your own consciousness. And some of those limiting conditions don't give up without a fight.
Oh, no. They seem to bring others with them.
Yeah.
It's amazing how, people of like mind will gather other people around and do everything they can to make it your issue or make it your problem. I had a very interesting experience, and it was a test for me as well. And I was in Mount Shasta, and with a group there, and a couple things, events happened, and all of a sudden, just everybody started going into process, and I just go, what is going on here? And I went to a couple other places, and the same thing was going on. And it was during the full moon and an eclipse, and I know those energies had something to do with it. But for a while there, I was saying, what the heck is going on? Everywhere I turn here, I'm running into challenges and adversity and just a lot of ego stuff, you know. And I just said, you know, I'm just going to stay centered and just let it go wherever it needs to go and not be pulled from my center. And finally, I actually had to confront it and just say, look, you know, it's, you know, what are all these judgments? You know, what is all this nonsense going on here? You know, what does this have to do with love? Maybe it's time everybody just take care of their own house first, you know, before getting into everybody else's business. And it just shut it right down, you know, immediately. Mm-hmm. But it was quite interesting watching that. And we get kind of spoiled. I know I do, living up here on the mountain. I forget what it's like to be, you know, go to the city or go to communities or get out of my little hermit box and go deal with social consciousness, you might say. It is quite a challenge to keep your center while you're walking through the chaos, you might say.
Yeah, it depends on what's one destiny is. I lived 16 years in a mountain ashram, and then by my own choice, but also because it was Swamiji suggested it, my husband and I came to the Palo Alto area, south of San Francisco, and we started this community here. We had the example of having worked with Swami Kriyananda to start the Ananda Village community near Grass Valley, and he'd really trained us in how to work with people and how to work in a very practical level. One of the things his guru, Yogananda, always said to him was, you have to be practical in your idealism. Which it's one thing to have really high ideals, and then it's quite another to be able to actually work with people and win them to the cause, to actually help other people change their consciousness and create environments in which people are facilitated in changing their consciousness. It's a unique work that Kriyananda has done with these communities and all the years that I'm working with him. That's why I put all the stories into this book, Kriyananda, as we've known him, because I've learned so much about how to translate it. I've always felt like a translator, like translating what I've intuitively known since childhood into an actual dynamic way to move through this world and relate to this world, not merely be isolating from this world. For some people, that's difficult. For others, like for me, that wouldn't be difficult. The difficult thing is to really be helpful to people where they're actually standing, with a vision that's much beyond where we're standing, but one that inspires rather than discourages, and one that translates. You know, here I am raising my kids. Here I am with this impossible schedule. How do I find time to meditate? How can meditation help me? What kind of meditation will help me? And how do I raise my kids? How do I get along with my husband or wife? How do I earn money? These are the realities of our time and place.
Mm-hmm. I know that there is training where you can actually train yourself while you're doing any kind of mundane task to turn it into a meditation.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's just training your mind how to focus. And most people, you know, have the soap opera on while they're ironing the clothes or doing the dishes or whatever, and they're, you know, filling their brains with all this drama and chaos and competition and at the same time they're doing their laundry, and they're actually in a form of meditation taking this all in and wonder why their lives are going to hell and have all this drama and competition and the lack of love in their lives.
You know, I have a lot of respect for my own delusions now. I feel like, you know, I tried for many years of my life to dismiss them. I insulted them. I called them foolish and how could you be so stupid and things like that. But after a while, I realized I've spent a lot of incarnations building up these misunderstandings, and I respect them. They are formidable opponents. And I respect them for the power that they have, the power that I've given them, and recognize that they only have power because I've given them power, but I've given them a lot of power. And so I have to be very strategic and systematic in how I dismantle them. Now, I'm not speaking of it being dangerous to try to dismantle them. I'm just saying they can't be dismissed.
It's exactly. Like,
yeah, you. It, I always think of those movies, you know, where or those boxing movies where the guy was going to go and meet the formidable opponent, but he had to train first because the first time he tried it, he got creamed.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, the ego thinks it's ready, and sometimes
yeah.
it, you know, jumps in there where it just hasn't been properly trained. I notice a lot of that I'm seeing, it seems like there's a real movement. A lot of people are trying to use drugs and recreational drugs and things like that as a path to enlightenment. And again, what I feel is that what they're doing is without the training, and you blast into these other realms and in the astral levels and things like that, you don't know what you're doing, and you don't know how to maintain your consciousness or stay focused or clear up any unseen negative influences. It can be very dangerous.
Well, you do. It's also the karmic law can't be cheated so readily. Oh, I don't actually have to do the long rounds of purification. I can just take these chemicals and I can just short circuit that whole process. It's like no such luck, you know. It just doesn't work like that. Karmic law cannot be mocked.
Mm-hmm.
Even the mere effort to do so in and of itself puts you on the wrong wavelength. It lacks devotion, it lacks humility, it lacks perseverance. The big problem with it, quite simply, is that it doesn't work. And yeah, I mean, if it worked, it would be just great.
And there's no driving enlightenment like golden arches or a little pill we can take to...
Not as far as I know. Certainly no. I have no scriptural authority or great master to tell me that it can be done that way.
I know something that helps, though. I'll have to admit, there is a... and I helped a physicist actually create this or get it out, but it's this oxygenated water, and he actually crystallized oxygen and stabilized it, you know, at room temperature, and it's a seven-sided crystal suspended in the water, and when you drink this, it's like prana in a bottle.
Isn't that interesting?
And your brain activates, it opens up, your heart opens up, and you start getting this tingly bliss feeling from it.
Huh.
And it's a door opening, but again, it's not the end-all. It doesn't take you away from your responsibilities and, you know, to do the work, but it's quite amazing. I've seen it help quite a few people, especially when it kind of takes you out of a frequency where if you are upset or sad or whatever, and if you get this really high octane stuff and drink it, all of a sudden you're happy for no reason.
You know, I read something interesting that in a commentary in the Bhagavad Gita that Kriyananda wrote. He said the life, the prana moves physically through the nerves, and the nerves gradually become clogged with toxins because of wrong diet and wrong thought, and then therefore the prana can't move. And that's why, you know, the masters put a great deal of emphasis on physical well-being to a point. So something like that probably has a deep, an immediate detoxifying effect, which allows more prana to flow, and even over a long term would allow more prana to flow. What you do with that prana depends on the purity of your consciousness.
Exactly.
It could just energize your delusions.
Yeah.
Give you more energy in the wrong direction. But, you know, there's an interesting point also that Swamiji said once that I found fascinating. He said, this particular age on the planet, even though it's ascending, is still too dense for a person to become truly liberated by mere physical purity. He said, in this age, devotion is a more powerful path.
Mm-hmm.
Because devotion opens the heart and puts you on the right frequency. He said in more subtle ages where the veil of matter is thinner, then you can refine the body and it has a more powerful effect on your consciousness. It was an interesting comment because you get some benefit from that now, but not enough.
No.
Devotion is better now.
Well, I've always felt, you know, there are little help aids along the way, but... the same thing is you can heal somebody on a physical level, but if they don't clear the pattern, it's just going to manifest again.
Right.
And the best pattern clear is the big eraser we all have within us, you know, that just has never happened. But we have to learn how to access that, and like you were saying, the devotion, and for me it's gratitude. It's even before the manifestation happens, giving thanks for it as it already happened, and staying that thankful mode or that gratitude mode seems to really accelerate the process.
Oh, I think definitely. And I do think right living and, you know, seven-sided oxygen molecules. I've been vegetarian and, you know, very conscientious about these things all my life, because if the body is really dense or ill, it takes a great consciousness to transcend it. Most of us get pulled down by what's physical, so attention to physical well-being is very important, but modifying the body through higher vibrations even than the physical world is also the real pathway.
Yeah, it seems like pain and you know, any kind of you don't teach, you know, enlightenment or scripture to a hungry man, you feed him first.
Right.
You know, the same with pain. Pain is a great distractor.
Yeah.
And so sometimes we have to, you know, get our consciousness off the pain and you know, focus on somewhere else, because the pain will always pull you right back, you know, here into the physical and ground you into this reality, and it's hard to override that sometimes.
Sometimes what you can do is you can see it in perspective. We started talking about humor, and you were talking about, you know, Kriyananda's humor, and seeing it in perspective. If your eye is right up against the black spot, everything looks black. If you stand back and see all the white field around the black spot doesn't get any lighter.
Mm-hmm.
It just gets smaller in relationship to the extent of one's own consciousness.
Yeah, I have a being that I work with by name of Ezekiel, and it's an ascended version of Ezekiel that merged with a feminine energy. And I experienced this after I had the near-death experience.
Uh-huh.
But one time, you know, I was dealing with the typical relationship issues, money issues, everything, and I was worrying about it, and I was trying to get an answer. Okay, how do I deal with this? How do I deal with this? How do I deal with this? And then next thing you know it, I had one of these white light experiences where I just went out of my body, shot out to the other end of the universe, looked back at the earth, and it looked like a pinhead.
Huh.
And I was this incredibly expanded being at the time, and all he said was, "This is who you are. And that is where your problems lie."
Huh.
And I realized that is that if we think we're just this little physical being down here with a personality, these problems are immense.
Right.
And they're overwhelming and we can't deal with them. But if we can get another perspective, like you're saying, and back away from that speck or that spot,
right,
and connect with our higher self or whatever you want to call it, in so many different levels to that, it just seems to fall away. All the issues I was dealing with when I came back just turned into a no thing and just fell away.
Yeah, that's what, you know, I've certainly, in all these 40 years that I've been doing this work, I've certainly seen myself recreate myself over and over and over again. And it's just been such a help to have a guide. You know, I have a guide out of the body, which is Yogananda, and a guide in a body, which is Kriyananda. And more than that, to see it embodied, not in someone who never has any experiences, but someone who's showing you how to meet it head on and transcend it again and again and again and again. Because when you climb over that mountain, all you see is another valley to go into and another mountain to climb over until you reach the final peak.
Yeah.
And that increased awareness is so magnificent as a teacher, either when you see it exemplified outside yourself or when you experience it in yourself, as you describe.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea where Yogananda is right now?
Well, his consciousness is infinite, so where could he not be?
Exactly. But some people say, oh, he's in fifth dimension or sixth dimension, or, you know, there's, you know, all people have all kinds of ideas. I've heard people, you know, channeling this message and that message about you know, where Yogananda is now and what he's doing.
But you see, if his consciousness, if he's in an absolute state of oneness with God, then there is no limited place that you could say. He's as near as people's attunement to him. He's a vibration of infinity. In the Holy Bible, in the Bible, it says, Jesus says, or John says, about Jesus, to all who received him, to them gave he the power to become sons of God, which that's a very explicit yogic statement about the relationship of the disciple and the guru, that the guru's transforming ray of consciousness is always available to those who are willing to put themselves in tune with it.
Mm-hmm.
And once you become in tune with it, it's like you become magnetized, like a plain piece of steel gets magnetized when a magnet is put next to it. But if the individual vibrates away from that or makes no attempt to receive it, then it simply hovers around you and never penetrates, and then you wonder where it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always tell people they're just a thought away. You know, just a loving, joyous, blissful thought away. You know, you don't have to hold them so far away.
Well, there was such a beautiful statement just before Yogananda died. Someone said, you know, after you are gone, you know, how can we be close to you after you are gone? And he said, to those who think me near, I will be near. And that's how just the living presence, even, you know, to this day, the masters reach us and they reach us. Other individuals may tune in and have an understanding that they pass on, but
mm-hmm.
it's not dependent. It's never been dependent on any instrument. Even the guru's own body is an instrument for something far beyond that.
I'm one of those weird people that see these unseen spirits, you know, all the time, and actually get photographs of them, which is kind of amazing. But the somebody called once, I'll never forget, I was doing a meditation here and just total blissed out and had all kinds of communication going, and they called, and so I went and got the phone. It was right towards the end of the meditation, and they said, what are you doing? And I said, oh, I'm just hanging out with some friends, you know. And they go, well, who's there? And I said, I couldn't really tell them who was there or who I was hanging out with.
Right.
And I said, well, just some friends. And they go, well, somebody stopped by. And I said, in a way, you know.
Yeah.
And what's sad is we hold, you know, the masters so far away and so high on these pedestals. And that belief is why we experience the separation.
Well, you know, it's an interesting way to put it. Because on the other hand, the more devoted one becomes, and because I've lived as a disciple my whole life, I know many people go in and out of this, but for me, my spiritual path has been discipleship, and Kriyananda's spiritual path has been discipleship to Yogananda, and I'm in a lineage of disciples, and the closer and deeper I come to know these masters, know Swami Kriyananda and Yogananda inwardly, the more I put them on a pedestal, in the sense that I want to say, the more I appreciate what true spiritual greatness is, and the more awe-inspiring I find that greatness. It's a strange thing, because simultaneously, one begins to recognize that greatness belongs to oneself as much as it belongs to them.
Exactly.
But one doesn't. I'm not saying this isn't exactly what you were saying, but it
mm-hmm.
reminded me of this, that one of the reasons I wrote this book about Swamiji is because I do want to restore people's understanding. Just because many people assert the right to be spiritual teachers and don't deserve that right,
mm-hmm.
or don't live up, let me phrase it differently, they don't live up to the hopes of some of the people who put their faith in them,
mm-hmm.
does not mean that there is no such thing as a great spiritual teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And we've become somewhat cynical about the possibility of a true relationship between a spiritual mentor and devotees. And it's very important that people understand the right relationship. Kriyananda's own life has been as a disciple of Yogananda and very humbly showing us how to live as a disciple. But that receptivity, that's why in the Bible, that's why John said that, to all those who received him.
Mm-hmm.
And unless there's that proper receptivity, it's all of a piece. You know, Christianity makes such a point about not favoring gurus, you know, in the churches, I should say,
mm-hmm.
not true Christianity. Churches make, some of them take such a stance against the Eastern ideas. But, you know, Christianity is the most guru-oriented religion in the world. Wonderfully so when rightly understood.
Well, yeah, exactly. I think rightly understood is
the key.
Something that if people would actually do the research and look in all the ancient texts and not have some preacher tell them, you know, what to think, but actually read it and, you know, read a lot of the new stuff that they're digging up that, you know, get copies of the Dead Sea Scrolls and things like that and, you know, study every culture. You know, put some time in and study every culture, every belief. You'll see that they are so similar.
Right.
And the base of them is pretty much the same, and then they've gotten distorted throughout time by kings and leaders and other people. But, I think in everybody's heart of heart, they know what's spirit and what's not, or what's true or authentic and what's not, you might say. And we've lost that inner sensitivity or that ability to discern, you know, is this really enlightenment I'm experiencing here from this person? Is this love and joy and bliss? And what kind of frequencies am I experiencing here? And, you know, they get caught in the mind and lose that ability to just discern and feel the frequencies of that being.
It's the great distinction between true spirituality and religion.
Mm-hmm.
Spirituality is from the infinite. Religion is man's attempt to encapsulate what is often a true vision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the great religions of the world were started by great masters, and there are returning saints through them. And it's the saints, really. And I don't mean the Catholic Church ordained saints,
mm-hmm.
but those of true elevated consciousness who are the messengers of truth, and even the scriptures need to be interpreted. But it's not, the true masters do not put themselves, that they put the responsibility back in the hands of the devotee.
Mm-hmm.
A true master, and people think, oh, well, I don't want someone else to take charge of my spiritual life. Well, no such luck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's always the responsibility of the individual to lift his own consciousness. And that's the image that I was using before. You can climb the mountain by yourself, or you can have a guide show you where the trail is. But one way or another, you're going to have to lift up your own feet.
Yeah, it's, I've always felt we have to honor everyone's, you know, unique purpose for incarnating or coming here, as well as they have to take responsibility for their own personal God connection. Nobody can just, you know, flip the switch and hand it to them. But, you know, there are way showers, or there are people that can assist them in making that journey a little easier, you might say.
It's been, for me, a godsend. Well, godsend, I mean that really literally. Because I've had Kriyananda in my life for so long, and, you know, much of what I wrote in this book, Kriyananda as we have known him, is the fact that I've been able to test my own intuitions against his experience again and again and again and again, so that I would have a sense of what was true. And then, because he's very, very articulate, and he's an American, and he has a Western understanding and speaks perfect English as well as seven other languages. But so I've been able to really, this is what I'm thinking, how does it read for you? And over all the years, with that, I've been able to gradually, you know, gain my own power, because just like when to learn to play the piano, to play the violin, to paint a picture, to toss a softball, whatever you try to do, if somebody knows how to do it already, then the transfer is on so many levels. It's a transfer literally of just hold it in your hand like this, and it's also a transfer of vibration of the more subtle, sort of the art side of it. If you're playing a musical instrument, you often play better when your teacher's in the room, just because there's a transfer of consciousness. But then when you play better, you know how it feels to play better, and you know how to do it on your own. We're an interrelated web.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's self-realization, but That's why Yogananda called his organization, it's a paradoxical name, Self-Realization Fellowship. Mm-hmm. How can you have a fellowship when it's an individual realization? But it's standing together and helping each other on the way.
Well, it makes total sense to me, but I've always been able to take two opposites and put them together. You know, it really is that way sometimes. I've always felt it is so important. Like up here, we have the Self-Mastery Earth Institute. And it's all about self-mastery. And we teach deep meditation techniques and inner sensitivity training and a lot of different things of that nature. But we really focus on individual empowerment and don't allow, you know, any worship outside of self or things, you know, of that nature here, because there's been so much of that on the planet, and people have been misled so much, you know, by so many different groups, and it's all about people taking responsibility. I also like what you're saying too about you couldn't recognize a great master unless there was a great master within self.
Yes.
Because you'd have no reference point.
Yes, that's exactly right.
But how many of us are actually living in alignment with that great master in self?
I appreciate how you describe the way your center is set up. You know, I'm such a devotee. I love worship.
Mm-hmm.
I love true worship. I love music. I love ritual, but only to the extent that it's inwardly reminding of inner consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of things that are just beautiful in themselves, but they've been lost to dogma and false understanding.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason that they had power in the first place is because human nature is uplifted from the heart. And I love the path that Yogananda created because it has Kriya Yoga, which is a profound and personal technique. But then it also has this great devotion.
Mm-hmm.
And worship, because even though ultimately one realizes the self and that one is the self, there's this long period in the middle where there is this the I-thou relationship, and the more you love, the more you can become united with that which you love.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always found in Yogananda's path, especially as Kriyananda lives it, this beautiful balance between this childlike devotion and great refined appreciation of the worshipful side of life. And the absolute power of Vedanta, which is this very impersonal, seeing everything as one with the spirit. It's a very interesting blend. I think it's the right blend for our times,
mm-hmm.
for this country. You know, there's so much heart in this country.
Yeah, it's just got to be activated.
Yeah, it's got to be activated. And I think there's a wonderful place for a much more strict balance against
mm-hmm.
Misunderstanding. So many people believe in God, but so few people go to church because, it, you know, God is it's not owned by anyone, and people define it in ways. I meet many atheists who come to our center, and they come as atheists, but I say to them, well, it's not really God you've rejected. It's somebody else's unacceptable definition of the word, because in English that word doesn't mean anything.
Now, there's over 11,000, I believe, religions out there with different images, and you know, people had experiences, and they gathered people around them to validate that experience so they could hang on to it or believe it, and it just got a little out of hand, you might say.
Right. And then there's the true masters who come regularly,
mm-hmm.
and their truths, well, because saints are created out of those teachings.
Mm-hmm.
Because individuals, even the Catholic Church, for all its flaws, nonetheless, there have been true saints in that church because they go through all of that, all that veneer,
mm-hmm.
and they go back to the power of Christ and receive Him.
And, you know, their message is always unifying. It's never separating.
It's never separating.
It's never dividing. And I think that's one of the biggest keys that we have to look at is you know, look at the fruits of what people are doing, you know, that we're talking about right action and right mind and things of that nature. And it seems as a whole, a lot of humanity has just lost their ability to look at, you know, common sense-based logic at what's going on and just say, you know, this isn't really right thinking. You know, this isn't right action going on here.
Yeah,
and we need to get back to the basics and start there.
This is why Yogananda's mission included the founding of communities, which is something that Swami Kriyananda has carried out, because
mm-hmm.
what's needed is examples, not just of individuals, because one person, people would say, well, she's an exceptional person,
mm-hmm.
but whole groups of people establishing their lives. What we've done with our communities, and we started in 1968, you know,
mm-hmm.
so it's really been going for a long time, and what we've done is we've said, okay, if self-realization is the goal of life, then how would you structure life itself? And
yeah.
you know, in this book, I've written all these stories of how you actually do that.
Yeah, I think we've got a caller on. We're coming up to the end of the hour,
uh-huh.
so you want to answer a question? Or?
Sure, it's up to you, whatever you like.
Okay, do we have a caller on? Okay. Well, we've got to close out here. We hit the end of the hour.
Okay.
And I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. I think we just touched the surface of...
Yeah, of course, we could talk for a long time. I'd like to encourage people to look for my book, Swami Kriyananda, As We Have Known Him. You can find it at Borders or Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can go on to doorofmyheart.com, and that'll take you directly to it.
Great, and I have the website up on the site as well.
Great, I'm happy to hear it. It's been very, very nice to talk to you. I love meeting you.
Yes, we'll have to connect in the physical and definitely have you on the show again.
Okay, next time you come, stop in.
I'll do that.
Okay.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Bless you. Bye-bye.
Bless you. Good night. Well, this is James Gilman with As You Wish, signing off. Have a great evening. Good night.